just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, July 28th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and
think. It just makes me stop and
think. It just makes me stop and think.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
A special look at the airline industry, government subsidies, labor rights, and customer service. A new report on dangerous mercury pollution from cement kilns. And Chris Hedges on the decline of the newspaper industry.
But I can't help myself. Why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Before we go to our first story, just want to report to our listeners about how KPFK began celebrating our 50th anniversary last night. We had a wonderful sold-out event at the Ford Amphitheater with over 1,200 KPFK listeners joining us for the Clash of the Pochos. I want to congratulate especially KPFK manager Sue Welch for a phenomenal job and everybody else who pulled in and made the event happen. We're going to have many, many more events throughout this year and next, celebrating KPFK, which turns 50 in 2009. The House of Representatives last week passed legislation intended to separate airlines from its government oversight agency, citing years of too cozy a relationship between the airline industry and the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA. The bill addresses a dangerous revolving door between the two groups and calls for a whistleblower office on safety matters. In March of this year, hundreds of aircraft with American Airlines, Delta, and Southwest were grounded for overdue safety inspections, frustrating thousands of passengers. In addition to safety, most airlines are charging passengers for every possible perk, from food service to checked-in bags. H.R. 6355, the Air Service Improvement Act of 2008, which is a passenger's bill of rights, is currently being considered by Congress. In June, a study by J.D. Power and Associates showed that airlines are suffering from the worst customer satisfaction in 3 years, primarily because of poor customer service rather than high fares. Now, airline and airport workers are making the connection between poor service and bad jobs. The Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, has a statewide campaign to improve jobs and services and security at California airports. According to SEIU, airlines are, quote, creating a crisis of inadequate training and equipment, low wages, and lack of health care that is robbing airline passengers of quality service and security. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, or LANE, released a report last week exposing the billions of tax dollars that airlines receive in government subsidies. In spite of these subsidies, says LANE, airline CEOs have, quote, failed to provide a fair return on the public's investment, creating poor quality jobs and providing inadequate security and services for passengers. Lane's co-author of the report that I just cited, Shortchanged, is Carolina Briones. She joins us on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Carolina.
Thank you for having me.
And also an organizer with SEIU, primarily focused on LAX, the Los Angeles International Airport, is Tim Maddox. Welcome, Tim.
Hello. How are you, Sonali?
Tim is a longtime airport worker. He currently works in the international terminal, assisting elderly passengers and passengers with disabilities. Carolina, I want to first start with you. I mean, I tried to lay the context of what the airlines are doing and how the passengers essentially are being charged, you know, for all sorts of things and are being treated pretty poorly. I think people would be surprised to know how much of our taxpayers' money goes into the airline industry. Explain the nature of the subsidies and even the size of the subsidies.
Yeah, well, it's really enormous. Once we started looking into it, we just found more and more. We calculated $8.5 billion in subsidies that have gone to the industry just since 2001. And it's really at all levels. There's a lot of, at the federal level, a lot of people are familiar with, you know, the 9/11 crisis and how that affected the industry. But what people don't know is that, you know, the industry really recovered from that crisis in 2006 and 2007 and became profitable again. And they were still getting lots of subsidies from the federal government.
Did the subsidies originate in the post-9/11 years, and was it for that reason?
that's where we see huge numbers, but it really goes back, you know, even to the 70s. We found local subsidies, which are low interest bond financing at LAX Airport, which is a local entity, and that goes back to the 70s. And you know, we found they'd gotten over $1 billion in that low interest financing. And there's subsidies at the state level that have gone back since before 9/11.
So
everything from tax breaks. Mm-hmm. You know, cash grants after 9/11, tax breaks. What we see a lot is the federal government kind of assuming the risk for the industry. So there's actually a program where the federal government acts as the insurer for the industry in case of what they call war risk. And, you know, so that's the federal government acting as the insurer, which is kind of unusual.
But quite consistent with how the Bush administration has been behaving in its tenure to many industries. So the subsidies are supposed to protect these airlines. But you said just in the last couple of years, the airlines have begun to turn a profit, but the subsidies continue?
Well, here's the thing. You know, right now, that was in 2006 and 2007. Right now, the industry is facing another big financial crisis because of the, you know, skyrocketing cost of oil, which we're all experiencing, right? And it's throughout the economy. It's hit the airlines very hard. So they're actually projecting big losses for this year. And that's why we think it's even more important to take a look at this because, you know, we're likely to be asked again as taxpayers to bail out this industry. Because they're facing another financial crisis. And so we thought now was a really good time to just take a look at our past subsidies. What kind of return are we getting on our investment as taxpayers? And, you know, with an eye to the future in case we're asked again.
Hmm. Tim, I want to bring you into the conversation. So Carolina has been talking about how our tax monies go to the airline industry. And yet as a worker, you know, you must come into contact with a lot of folks who work for the airlines. But also that's very much linked to those who work at airports like yourself. What is the sort of conditions under which workers like yourself work, given, again, these large subsidies and certainly profits, at least in 2006 and 2007?
Well, I've been working at the airport almost 14 years now, and I haven't seen the standards this way in a long time. I was a wheelchair person that helps and assists elderly and the disabilities, passengers with disabilities. And it's a serious problem with lack of training and proper equipment being issued to the workers. So it really suffers, you know, the customer service suffers because of that.
Now, how linked are the airport workers with airline workers?
Well, we do a lot of things, everything from security, from assisting passengers, cleaning of the planes, in which we just had a thing last week where we talked about cabin crew cleaners not having enough time to do their jobs. They're often rushed, overworked, and understaffed. And even given a situation where they have to clean the airplanes, they don't have chemicals and things that they need to do their jobs.
So you're saying that basically workers, the cleaning staff, may go into an airplane between flights, and they may not have enough time to clean the flight enough for the next set of passengers. I mean, this is pretty intense.
yeah, it is. They report of not being able to change pillowcases, blankets. They don't have chemicals sometimes for the restroom to disinfect. And the same is also across the board, whether it deals with security or it deals with my position, in which passengers have been dropped because we don't have the training of how to deal with people with disabilities.
Drop meaning physically drop while you're actually carrying passengers with disabilities.
Yes, because there's like a lot of times you're asked to do jobs outside of your job description. So sometimes I may be pulled out of one area and say, okay, you need to go search the plane for dangerous objects, and we haven't been trained to do that, including bombs. They say, "Oh, well, go look."
You've been asked to search a plane for bombs?
Yes, yes.
But but your expertise is in helping passengers with disabilities and the elderly.
Right. So this is a common thing. Like if you're short-staffed in one area, they'll call you off to do security. Oh, you go just do this, or you go do that, and you're not really trained for it.
And I understand that with regard to the cleaning staff, that there was an action recently where SEIU workers were handing sanitation wipes to passengers as they got off the planes.
Yeah. And it's really, you know, it's a thing where passengers are really disgusted, and they should be, because of just what Carolina was talking about, the subsidies and all the money that they've gotten, they don't put back, you know, to the workers or the community as far as good jobs.
Carolina, link the airport subsidies and sort of how this industry operates with the airlines. How linked are these two groups?
Well, you know, exactly what Tim was talking about is part of a broader trend. Is the airlines are just looking for so many ways to cut their costs. And one of the things they've done is outsource these jobs, right? So what Tim is talking about are, you know, folks that work for airline contractors. So the airlines are ultimately responsible for their conditions. And that's one way they've really driven down job quality in the industry. When they contract out, the contractors compete against each other to be the lowest bidder. And that really drives down standards. And the other way is they've also cut wages and benefits for their own employees. So, you know, we see really poor job quality. And we also, as you're talking about, we see poor conditions for passengers. I mean, the two are directly related. And, you know, people have seen how the airlines have been in the headlines with safety problems, customer service problems.
And when you say the airlines are outsourcing passenger services, what exactly does that mean?
It basically means that some of these critical duties, like Tim was talking about, security sweeps, you know, other security functions, service to people with disabilities, that they're being contracted out. Essentially, they're not done by airline employees. They're being outsourced to contractors that work for the airlines. And they really, you know, have this low bid contracting system that really drives down standards.
Tim, make the connection that we've sort of danced around, and Carolina referred to it as well. Explain to our listener who may have taken a flight recently, had a terrible experience, maybe was even treated, you know, rudely by a harried check-in counter person. Make the connection between poor job quality and customer service. Make the case to the listener why the condition of your job is linked to the poor service that they have received.
Well, when you have a system, I mean, I think Carolina was talking about a low bidding system of whoever does the contract cheaper gets the contracts there at the airport. What happens is that either your hours get cut as workers, you have not very good health care, so you have in return you get a high turnover. So you don't have experienced workers on the job that can do, you know, a quality job for you. And the only way that we're going to deal with customer service is to deal with the situation of the working conditions with people that, you know, we have people that barely have health care and part-time jobs. And we understand that this economy is bad, but the workers are really suffering at this point, too.
And I wanted to go back to one thing that you were discussing regarding passengers with disabilities in airports in particular. You know, there's always rushing. There's always, as you said, short staffing. What about the conditions of wheelchairs? This is something I know SEIU has brought up.
Right. With the company that I was working for, they didn't have proper equipment. A lot of the wheelchairs were broken. In fact, one of the persons that we interviewed had gotten dropped because of a broken wheelchair. So as far as the wheelchair conditions, and also aisle chairs, which are specific chairs that deal with people who are quadriplegic or paraplegic, aren't functioning well either.
My guests are Tim Maddox and Carolina Briones. Tim Maddox is an LAX organizer with SEIU. Carolina Briones is with Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. She's the co-author of the report, Shortchanged, How Airlines Can Repay Taxpayers for Billions in Subsidies by Improving Jobs, Security and Services. So, Carolina, let's talk about this subtitle, How Airlines Can Repay Taxpayers. What do you mean by that? What can be done at this point?
Yeah, well, what we're basically calling for is just a major change in the way these subsidies work, right? What we found is that, you know, billions of dollars have gone to this industry with very few strings attached, really. I mean, very few conditions, just, you know, more and more subsidies. And so what we're saying, especially now that the airlines are facing another crisis, we really have to, if we're going to continue to subsidize this industry, we have to set some standards that go along with the subsidies. There have to be conditions for any future subsidies around job quality, around service quality for passengers. So that's one thing. That's a major point that we're making, is attaching conditions to these subsidies. And then we're also saying, you know, the airlines should really be acting now. They are in a financial crisis, but they can do better. They, with a modest investment, they can actually improve conditions for some of the workers that we're talking about. And that's going to pay off in the long run for the industry in terms of improved productivity. There's been research that's been done by an MIT professor specifically on this industry, saying if you invest in your workforce, productivity goes up, and ultimately you become more profitable as an industry. And so we are really calling on the airlines to recognize that.
And Carolina, are there any particular companies that are worse than others, or is there, for example, one airline that or two airlines that you can cite that do treat its workers well and has consequently better customer service?
Gosh, I wish I could give you an example. I mean, what we find is that, you know, the kind of airlines just, you know, they kind of, if the conditions go down to whatever's legally acceptable, you know, and they're all kind of at that level of you know, what they have to do according to law.
And do you know how they compare with, for example, out-of-country airlines, other countries, national airlines, or even other private airline
That's
companies?
That's a good question. I don't have information specifically on labor standards in other countries. One thing I do know that's different about, say, some of the European airlines compared to the American is that they have much higher fuel economy in their jets. And so even though they're, you know, they're also suffering from oil prices, it's not as much as you see the American airlines flying a much older fleet, less fuel efficient.
So our fleet is like the cars on our roads, much less fuel efficient
it's
than
like
our
Hummer,
European,
you know,
counterparts.
It's Hummers. The American airlines are driving Hummers and they're complaining about the cost of gas. So.
Right, and it's also an issue of climate change. Finally, Tim, let's talk about this website that SEIU has set up. How is your flight.com? It's an interesting website where you're basically encouraging passengers to log on and share their horror stories, if you will.
Yeah, that's howwasyourflight.com, and we've gotten a lot of things that the passengers really discuss it at a lot of their flight experiences. So we want to encourage listeners to check out the website and give us you know, some feedback on your experience, your flight travel.
What's the goal of the site?
Well, basically to bring out, like, you know, the conditions and the link, the problem between customer satisfaction and worker productivity.
So on the site, you also have information about how workers are treated and also some of the actions and stuff that SEIU is taking?
Well, yeah, we want to just take in some information and get some information about, you know, passengers' flight experiences and kind of compile that information. And that's, I think that's how Carolina was able to get some of her information for her report.
And I want to also go to some of the actions that both your organizations have been taking at the airport. Carolina, I understand that you were out there handing peanuts to passengers last week.
Yes, we were. We decided to do a little bit of street theater, and we had some folks dressed up as airline CEOs who were very happy to receive billions in fake dollars in our skit and then give passengers peanuts. And the message was, you know, we're getting billions of your tax dollars and you're getting peanuts.
And are passengers even getting peanuts these days on
their
flights?
Exactly.
That's
not
a good
even
question.
Peanuts.
Maybe they charge you a dollar for a little packet of peanuts.
Exactly. Can I just mention the website where folks
Absolutely.
Can get more information about the report?
Yes.
It's www.shortchangedreport.org.
And they can download the whole report.
They can download the whole report and lots of background information as
That's shortchangedreport.org. Next time you take a flight and want to know how much the airline you were flying got from you before you even bought your ticket in terms of your taxes, you can check out Shortchanged the Report. It's how airlines can repay taxpayers for billions in subsidies by improving jobs, security, and services. Tim, there's an action coming up that SEIU is planning?
Yes, on the 31st, on Thursday, we'll be at the airport at the International Building at about 12:30. So we're offering people can come out and participate. We've had community activists, the religious community, Reaching Higher Coalition is a compilation of those people.
And what is the goal of the action?
Well, we want to bring awareness around this, our conditions there.
And the working conditions?
We are the working conditions. And also we're in the middle of a contracting fight.
And so that's this Thursday, the 31st, at the International Terminal at 12:30 at LAX Airport?
Right, on the arrival level.
All right. Well, Tim Maddox, and I guess the website is howwasyourflight.com for listeners to check out. Mm-hmm. And shortchangereport.org is the website that Lane's report is linked to. Carolina Briones and Tim Maddox, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Carolina Briones is the co-author of the report Shortchanged. She is with the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. And Tim Maddox, longtime airport worker, works in the International Terminal and is an LAX organizer with SEIU. We're going to do a follow-up to this story in the coming weeks regarding H.R. 6355, the Air Service Improvement Act of 2008, which is a passenger's bill of rights currently being considered by Congress. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll learn about mercury pollution and what the EPA is failing to do about it. After this week's Empire Notes, Chris Hedges joins us to talk about the decline of the newspaper industry. Stay with us. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is about John McCain's campaign.
Welcome to the desert of the political. In the vast Saharan stretch devoid of inspiration, interest, or indeed any signs of life but the gag reflex that has been this summer's presidential campaign, there's been only one bright spot, the comedic stylings of the John McCain clown show. It's hard to know where to begin. Just keeping up with McCain's sophisticated, multifaceted push for the brain-dead voter has become a full-time job. You could look to last week, which juxtaposed Barack Obama's stirring, if empty, Ich bin ein World Citizener speech to 200,000 in Berlin's Tiergarten, where he beautifully sugarcoated a call for Europeans to send more troops to kill and die in Afghanistan and got them to love him for it, with John McCain's failed photo op in the utterly dramatic venue of a grocery store, where he was upstaged by a guy dropping pickle jars all over the floor, and where the random shopper he talked to was actually supplied by the local Republican Party. Deviousness in the service of incompetence. That is the face of the new Republican Party. Or perhaps we should consider the jaw-dropping stupidity and dishonesty of McCain's last two campaign ads. In the first, he actually says Barack Obama is the reason for high gas prices. Perhaps it was Obama who also caused the decline of the witty, lighthearted romantic comedy. If you thought he couldn't top that, Jake Tapper of ABC's description of his second ad says it all. Quote, new McCain ad bashes Obama for not visiting troops, using footage of Obama visiting troops. In McCain's voiceover, he says that Obama, quote, made time to go to the gym, but canceled a visit with wounded troops. When Obama's campaign staff was advised of the Pentagon's concerns with his planned visit to Landstuhl, they figured they were in a catch-22. Do the visit and have the right wing go nuts, claiming that Obama was politicizing the troops, or not do it and have them claim that Obama was a troop-hating secret Muslim? Clearly, they made the wrong choice strategically. Better to be criticized for visiting wounded soldiers than for not. But there is not one iota of evidence that Obama departs from the reigning ethos of troop idolatry. We could talk about McCain's novel geographical insight into the need to police the Iraq-Pakistan border. I give him a pass on the numerous Czechoslovakia references since the entire right wing seems unclear on the end of the Cold War. Or his insistence on TV that, in fact, we were greeted as liberators in Iraq. Back in 2003, there were, of course, numerous instances where American soldiers were greeted with flowers and cheers, but that is what defenseless people always do with occupying armies of uncertain intent. And, by far the most important thing, after years of saying that anyone who spoke of timetables for withdrawal was a traitor who wanted America to surrender to the enemy, including Mitt Romney, who didn't even say anything, John McCain has suddenly flip-flopped on his only signature issue, accepting, of course, impaired oxygen flow to the brain, of which he is the primary champion in the American political realm, to start saying that Maliki's timetable is fine, even though it's the same as Obama's timetable. John McCain has actually sunk below George Bush in intellectual content and rhetorical style, something that I hadn't realized was possible. But life is a learning experience. The left is making the mistake of concentrating its fire on Barack Obama during this election. It's good to criticize him and go on doing so, although most of that criticism is so disengaged that it can have no real effect, but let us not ignore John McCain. Despite his manifest absurdity, this crazy man still has a chance of winning the presidency. After all, Obama, whether or not he is a secret Muslim, is an out-of-the-closet black and a practicing homo sapiens, both generally liabilities in American politics. Most important, the media, John McCain's base, has somehow contrived to ignore everything he has done and said, perpetuating the myth that he's a knowledgeable straight talker. The public as well still credits McCain with more foreign policy knowledge than Obama and trusts him more on Iraq, even though it disagrees with his stance, or one of his stances, on it. There is more to this phenomenon than McCain's habit of supplying the press with Dunkin' Donuts. There's obvious racial politics behind this, and identifying such things used to be part of the business of the left. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. Less than 2 weeks after carrying out orders to lay off 150 newsroom workers, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times resigned earlier this month in protest. The Times now finds itself without a publisher, advertising director, foreign editor, editorial editor, or UN bureau chief. And Sam Zell, owner of the Times, says that the downsize results from, quote, some of the worst advertising numbers in the history of the world. The LA Times is owned by the Chicago Tribune, whose editor also resigned after 7 years on the job after the paper announced that 80 positions would be cut. Newspapers across the country face similar problems, and readers worry that journalistic quality will suffer. In his recent article, So Goes the Newsroom, the Empire, and the World, veteran journalist Chris Hedges writes critically of the dangerous influence of corporations on news. Hedges argues that democracy requires unbiased information and an educated populace, but he sees threats to both in modern American society. He concludes that these shifts are, quote, leaving us deaf, dumb, and blind. Chris Hedges is a former correspondent for the New York Times for nearly two decades. He's the author of several books and a guest here on Uprising quite often. His latest book is I Don't Believe in Atheists, and his article about the newspaper industry is on truthdig.com as well as commondreams.org. He joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Uprising, Chris.
Thank you.
So the standard wisdom, Chris, is that the internet killed the newspaper. What do you say to that?
Well, it's not quite that simple. There are many factors that have gone into killing newspapers, the primary factor being, of course, the flight of advertising revenue, which has seen a precipitous decline, especially recently in the last a few months. This decline has been quite dramatic. I mean, we've seen 6,000 journalists. I mean, you just recited what's happening to the LA Times, but nationwide, 6,000 journalists have lost their jobs this year alone. News pages are being radically cut back. Newspaper stocks have tumbled. I think the New York Times is down around $12 or something. Advertising revenues have, in most papers now, fallen, have double-digit drops, and you have some of the largest publishing companies like McClatchy, which publishes the Miami Herald, has seen shares fall by 77% in the last year. The San Francisco Chronicle is losing $1 million a week. There is an acceleration of the implosion and destruction within newspapers. I think that the question is whether newspapers can be transferred to the internet, and I think that it's clear now that the internet will not save newspapers.
So just on the point of advertising leaving newspapers or this loss of advertising, one might imagine that it's the internet that's pulling away advertising from newspapers. Is that at all accurate?
Not to newspaper websites, and that's the problem for newspapers. Newspaper websites make up less than 10% of newspaper ad revenue, and although net advertising amounts to about $21 billion a year, this is, given the newspaper industry, incredibly small. The fact is that most advertisers have stayed away from newspaper websites, whether that's because they're unsure of how to use the internet, or they're suspicious that it can't match viewer attention of the older media, or I don't know. But the notion that the internet is going, that it's just another delivery system, is false.
So essentially, just on that point again, the nature of the internet is such that all that advertisers care about is how many hits a site gets. It's almost as though every website is a de facto newspaper from the perspective of an advertiser, and so all these advertising dollars are being spread out over
right.
more sites.
Right. You know, the newspaper websites have just not been able to corral the advertisers the way the print medium could. And that's the problem. And that's a very serious problem. I am not at all blind to the corporate intrusion in the newspaper business. After all, unfortunately, we live in a nation where five corporations, Time Warner, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, General Electric, and Viacom, at this point control almost everything we read, watch, hear, and ultimately think. But at the same time, newspapers are a vital instrument in maintaining a democracy. And when they're well run, they are more than a business. They're a public trust. They provide the means for citizens to examine themselves, to ferret out lies, to, you know, the abuse of power by elected officials, large newsrooms. The LA Times, of course, it's slashing and burning, but it's now down still to about 700 people. Hire people to write about City Hall, the state capitol, political campaigns, sports, music, art, theater. They keep readers engaged with their cultural, civic, and political life. And when I started as a foreign correspondent in Latin America about 25 years ago, most of the major city papers, including like the Philadelphia Inquirer, Dallas Morning News, Miami Herald, had bureaus in Latin America, in the Middle East, in Europe, in Asia, in Moscow. There was an effort to show Americans the world beyond our borders, how people looked, what they thought, what they believed. All of that's virtually gone. Or in the process of being dismantled. Mm. And the consequences are going to be tremendous, because the internet is not, you know, there may be a few sites like ProPublica or Slate or the Truth Dig, which I write for, that attempt to protect news gathering. But their staffs are tiny. They don't compare to papers. And most of the internet is parasitic in the sense that, you know, they feed off of reporting by traditional news gathering industries like newspapers and wire services, I'd guess probably 80%. And if you take that away, we're left with, you know, a gigantic black hole that I don't see how it's going to be filled.
Now, Chris, you say in your article the decline of newspapers is about the rise of the corporate state. And isn't it, you know, if you sort of dig beneath the surface and look at the larger picture, isn't it true that essentially newspapers are run as businesses, and the goal of every business is to make money ultimately? The bottom line is what's at stake. Would you say that in a way, newspapers maybe have killed themselves because they're run as businesses rather than functioning in the public trust, perhaps as nonprofits?
Well, that's a theory that advocates, you know, John Carroll and others have put out, that if newspapers maintain their role as a public trust, they will keep their readers. I'm not sure that that's true, and I think commercial television is a good example of that. The fact is, by pandering to celebrity gossip and salacious garbage and trivia, and we've seen commercial news networks now essentially do this, ratings go up. People like that trash. It's the lowest common denominator, and it works. And that's why television news no longer has foreign bureaus. It's why virtually there is no news on television. But they make money. And this is, you know, the consolidation of the media by large corporations, I mean, like General Electric, which, of course, is not only controlling the information we get, but making the weapon systems that drive and help fuel the military-industrial state that we live in. To steal a line from Neil Postman, where we're all sort of being, amusing ourselves to death. The FCC, this is just an example of how far our standards have fallen. defined shows like Fox Celebrity Gossip Program, TMZ, and the Christian Broadcast Network 700 Club, and I'm quoting, as bona fide newscasts.
Right, which of course allows them to get away with much more editorializing than they would otherwise be able to. Chris Hedges is my guest, a former correspondent for the New York Times for nearly two decades, veteran journalist, reported from many, many countries around the world, and really knows the newspaper industry intimately. He's written an article about the newspaper industry called So Goes the Newsroom, the Empire, and the World. Now, you talked about television news, and you talked about also how the internet has been parasitic in terms of news gathering. I'm wondering, you know, if we look at how the music industry has been in a way redefined by the rise of the internet, which has been parasitic to that industry as well, and with the advent of videos and popularity of online videos, whether you think the television industry is going to go that route as well, where it may also start to lose money. And could all of this perhaps in the end not be a good thing? Could it not be a situation where we get more access, public access to information, to music, to videos, and have it be a sort of more democratic form of information sometime in the future?
I think not. I think we live under the illusion that we can transfer. Let's just take news gathering, which is something I know a little more about than the music industry, to the internet. You know, people, those who rely on the internet, they gravitate towards sites that reinforce their beliefs. And most of these internet sites, especially I think the ones that descend into the worst kind of propaganda and editorializing, filter information through an ideological lens. That's, you know, we see that, you know, through Fox News. We see it on commercial TV. But that process defies the purpose of reporting. Good reporting is about transmitting information that doesn't care what people think. It is meant to challenge or countermand or destabilize established beliefs. It's very time-consuming and often very expensive. And it begins from the premise that there are things that we should know and understand, even if these things make us uncomfortable. And I think that's the ethic that we're losing, and we're losing it to. I think the internet is culpable in this, and a kind of pandering and partisanship, in just sort of competing propaganda. Bloggers don't admit errors; they don't pick up a phone, much less report. They can't get fired. I think for most bloggers, facts are interchangeable with opinions. And what I fear is that, the future of what we call news is going to end up looking like the Drudge Report.
Hmm. Chris, finally, what advice then do you give to both the lovers of newspapers, those of us who love reading newspapers and holding an actual paper in our hand, and the industry itself, and particularly newsroom workers?
Well, it's part of a wider problem in that, you know, we are moving from a print-based society to an image-based society. You know, the readers of the New York Times, from surveys, the average reader of the print edition of the Times spends 45 minutes reading the paper. The average viewer of the Times on the internet spends about 7 minutes. Browsing isn't reading. And I think that this is part of a kind of cultural degeneration. It's not just about the rise of the corporate state, although, of course, the corporate state has a vested interest in shutting the prying eyes of reporters as they rape the country. It's not just about the loss of civic and public responsibility on the part of our entrepreneurial class, but it's also, finally, about the intellectual poverty of a post-literate world, a world where information is now conveyed primarily through rapidly moving images rather than print.
And do you also sort of see a major generational difference? I mean, one of the difference between those reading times that you mentioned, 7 minutes on the New York Times website versus 45 minutes in the print edition, may be a generational difference.
Well, certainly, because, as with the rise of the internet and you know, with the sort of infusion of television into the lives of children, we have created a world where there's less and less space for people to exist as literate human beings. And by that I mean, you know, there's a huge difference between reading a 400-page book and taking apart its arguments, deconstructing its arguments, and grappling with complexity and ambiguity, which can only be done in that kind of length, and leaping from channel to channel or website to website. And I think that we are seeing, you know, this cultural impoverishment of which I think the internet is part. That's my dog. Sorry. Cultural impoverishment destroy the very pillars that have allowed us to remain informed about the world around us, and a society that loses the capacity to distinguish between lies and truth can no longer be called a democracy.
Chris Hedges, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll link to your site from our website.
Thank you.
Chris Hedges, former correspondent for The New York Times for nearly two decades, author of several books, his latest, I Don't Believe in Atheists. We've had him on the program before. You can read his article about the newspaper industry on its decline at commondreams.org as well as truthdig.com. You are listening to Uprising, and after this short break, we will be right back with the rest of the show, focusing on a new report about how the EPA is failing to regulate mercury pollution. Stay tuned.
Everyone at KPFK thanks you, the listener, for your generous pledge during our last fund drive. As a listener-sponsored station, we do not sell the airwaves to advertisers. It's thanks to your continued support that we can proudly keep KPFK powered by the people. So please remember how important it is to pay your pledge in a timely fashion. You may pay or make a new pledge online at kpfk.org by clicking Support KPFK, or send your payment in the envelope we sent you. We appreciate every dollar and remain committed to bringing you commercial-free independent radio.
Welcome back to Uprising. A new study released by the Environmental Integrity Project and Earth Justice has found that mercury pollution from cement kilns is nearly double the level projected by the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. According to the environmental groups, 23,000 pounds of mercury emissions are released into the air every year. The report also claims that the EPA was negligent for over a decade in terms of imposing regulations on cement plants emitting thousands of pounds of toxic mercury annually. Two Northern California cement kilns are singled out as being among the nation's worst mercury polluters. The emission rates from plants in Cupertino and Davenport make the Bay Area the highest mercury-polluted region in the state. As a neurotoxin, mercury in the smallest amounts can cause adverse health conditions, especially in pregnant women and young children. Contamination in bays and oceans can also make certain fish unsafe to eat. As a result of the Environmental Integrity Project and Earth Justice's findings, the groups are calling on the EPA to adopt a mercury standard and enforce it by regulatory testing by state agencies. My guest is Eric Schaefer. He is the director of Environmental Integrity Project. Welcome to Uprising, Eric.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. So first, explain the mercury emissions from cement kilns. I mean, we hear, particularly pregnant women and young children, are advised to not eat fish, or particularly those fish that are known to have high levels of mercury. But this type of pollution, how is it different from what we know of more traditionally?
Well, mercury, as I think you laid out very nicely, is a very deadly poison. It's a neurotoxin. It interferes with the development of fetuses, so it's especially dangerous for pregnant women. And the way the public gets exposed is primarily through eating contaminated fish. Almost every state, including California, has advisories warning you to limit your intake of fish because they are, in so many places, contaminated with mercury. And one of the big sources of mercury exposure actually is the air emissions from plants like the ones we studied.
So rather than from fish that you eat, actual sort of gas emissions that people can breathe in?
No, not so much that. It's more that what goes up has to come down.
Mm.
So when you get emissions from cement kilns or power plants, eventually it rains back down into lakes and rivers, and there it gets taken up by the fish.
Now, what about the? Who has been the more traditional target, if you will, of people upset about mercury pollution? You usually hear of cement plants being the worst polluters.
No, you don't. I live on the East Coast, and one of the biggest targets in the U.S. are coal-fired power plants. So you don't have too many of those in California, very few, but we have a lot in the Midwest and in the East, and they're big mercury sources. But what our study found is that at least for the biggest cement plants, the worst polluters, they are as bad as coal-fired plants, and that's especially true of the ones you have in California.
So let's talk about what the EPA has or really hasn't done. Your study found that that mercury emissions are twice as high as the EPA has acknowledged, and this is the agency that's supposed to regulate this sort of pollution?
Yeah, that's right. Sadly, EPA was supposed to have regulated mercury back in 1997 under the Clean Air Act. That hasn't happened. There have been no less than four lawsuits to try to get the agency to do what Congress told it to do so many years ago.
And the EPA, I mean, we just talked about the Clean Air Act last week with respect to, a couple of weeks ago, I think, with respect to climate change and how the EPA has tried to avoid using the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. It seems as though the Clean Air Act has really not even been used to regulate these sorts of more traditional types of pollution like mercury.
No, in fact, EPA has really taken a beating from the federal courts, including on the mercury issue, but also on the greenhouse gas issue that you mentioned, for failing to do its job and regulate these pollutants as the law requires.
So
it's been going on for years and, of course, gotten much worse under the Bush administration.
Eric, what do some of these cement plants do that causes this kind of mercury pollution? I mean, could they be using better materials or better types of infrastructure?
That's an excellent question, and what we think causes the mercury pollution, I should really say what EPA has found, is the problem is you have some feedstocks, limestone primarily, that are higher in mercury content than others, that are quite high in mercury content. Also, some of these plants burn coal for fuel, and between the coal and the feedstock, you see plants with higher mercury emissions. So one of the first things you can do is to control what you put in the cement kiln that makes the cement. You can find a different type of limestone. You can switch to natural gas instead of coal. Second thing, of course, you can do is you can put on emission controls. There are technologies that will take mercury out of the air, and if you're able to do that, you can safely manage the waste and keep it from getting into the environment.
So the EPA is really the only agency, government agency that is, that one ought to rely on to do this kind of regulation, to force these cement plants to carefully regulate their emissions?
Well, I think it's fair to say EPA has the primary responsibility. There's nothing to stop California or the local air quality districts from having their own standards to limit mercury emissions.
And how is California on that issue?
Well, California has cement kilns. You have four of the top 10 mercury emitters in the U.S. among cement kilns. In Tehachapi, in the southern part of the state, you've got the second largest mercury source for a cement kiln at nearly 500 pounds, actually at over 500 pounds. Up in Cupertino, you've got the third largest in the U.S. So California is not doing so well. You don't have mercury from coal plants because you don't have coal plants. But you do have mercury from cement kilns in a pretty big way.
And is this sort of, a bit of a revelation for those of us here on the West Coast who might have felt, that we were, in a way, better off than the East Coast?
Well, in many ways you are, because, again, we rely so much for coal to make our electricity in the East, and you don't have that problem in California. And I think in other ways you've done a very good job reducing emissions from tailpipes from automobiles and trucks. The cement kilns are really kind of a sleeper issue, and they were an industry that was given to the federal agency to regulate, and so I'm assuming California was kind of waiting for the U.S. EPA to do its job. But as we said earlier, they've been waiting now more than 10 years.
And so you think that in the meantime, while the EPA is dragging its feet and may or may not actually do anything, that local and statewide air quality districts can, air quality agencies can at least try to do some regulating?
Definitely. One very simple thing to do for these cement kilns is require them to continuously monitor mercury emissions. Right now, we have estimates based on limited testing that's done occasionally or based on sampling of the feedstock. There's technology you can put on these plants that will tell you by the hour what the mercury emissions are. That's something states can require, and they really ought to do so right now.
And we talked earlier in the interview about how the mercury actually gets into a human system. Prenatal and infant mercury exposure, according to your report, can cause mental retardation, cerebral palsy, deafness, and blindness. So very serious neurotoxin. So fish is essentially, eating fish is the way in which mercury enters one's body. But fish is supposed to be one of those healthy meats, and doctors say you should eat fish, but then you shouldn't for the mercury. I mean, what are people to do?
Absolutely. Well, you know, you can eat a certain amount of fish safely if you are, particularly if you're buying saltwater fish. If you are a nursing mother, you have to be very, very careful because the Center for Disease Control, that's another federal agency, says nearly 10% of women of childbearing age have more mercury in their bloodstream than is really considered safe.
And is mercury one of those chemicals that essentially accumulates in the body?
It does. It bioaccumulates. That's an excellent question, which is why when you eat the fattier kinds of fish, like bluefish, for example, you have to worry more about the mercury content. So some fish are higher in mercury than others.
And so it's not a matter of, giving your body a time to get rid of it. I mean, once you eat something with high mercury content, that mercury stays in your body.
Yes, it will stay in for some period of time. Of course, if you stop eating fish altogether, which we're certainly not recommending.
Eric, we're having trouble hearing you. Your phone is cutting out. Are you with us? Well, unfortunately, we've lost Eric Schaefer, but we're nearly at the end of the program anyway. Eric Schaefer is the director of the Environmental Integrity Project, and certainly listeners can check out the report with all of the information that Eric was discussing, including the issue of fish, at the websites environmentalintegrity.org as well as earthjustice.org. Earth Justice and the Environmental Integrity Project are the two organizations that had put together this report that we've just been discussing, and the report is titled, it's entitled Cementing a Toxic Legacy, How EPA Has Failed to Control Mercury Pollution from Cement Kilns, and that's the topic of our last segment today. You are listening to Uprising. We will link to this website and all the websites we refer to on the show through our site at kpfk.org. If you click on Programs in the left column, follow that all the way down to Uprising, you'll find our website. Again, very excited about yesterday's event, the Clash of the Pochos. That was a wonderful event at the Ford Amphitheater. We ended up selling out the venue, over 1,200 listeners joining us. Thank you to everybody who showed up to that event. We will have many more events between this year and next year celebrating KPFK's 50th anniversary. So if you missed yesterday, don't worry, we've got many more events that will be coming up. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Henrik Tikkanen once said, "Because we don't think about future generations, they will never forget us." That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Our interns are Natalie Yar and Margaret Joe. Tamika Zoki is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.